And welcome back. As the breezes die down after the nuclear explosion, will we have World War III? Will there be a nuclear exchange? I don't have the answer. I think the best way to sum it up is, if that's what the global elite want, they're going to get it. They'll make it happen. I don't think there's anything left to chance anymore. So whatever their decision, that's what we're going to endure. Or hopefully endure. We're going to encounter it at the very least. Donald Schmidt is back tonight. Don is one of the great, he's a giant. He and Tom Carey have done more to help the world, especially Americans, understand what happened in Roswell in 1947 than anyone else. Their books are wonderful books to read, every one of them. You can pick them up, open them up anywhere and start reading and be amazed. They're that good. And Don has, again, gone into areas that few would even think of going into. He's been at this a long time. He knows the game, and he knows the truth. And there's something about Roswell we're going to talk about tonight that very few people have ever pointed out. It's a very important issue, and I think you're going to find this to be very interesting. Most all of you know about Roswell, the so-called beginning of the UFO ET era. Actually, it was much before that, but we'll leave it at that, because pop culture is pop culture. Fascinating story. Remarkable events went on there. And I do hope that, and I've said this several times, that both Don and Tom get to hold a piece of the memory medal at some point before times run out. Hello, Don, and welcome back.
Well, good evening, Jeff, and always great to be back with you. So thank you for having me once again.
My pleasure. Roswell, we just finished the war, so to speak. We won the war. The Constitution is being held up high, and the Bill of Rights, and our First Amendment, and our Second Amendment, and on and on. Things were remarkable in the mid to late 40s.
Yes, yes.
And yet, when Roswell happened, reality made an appearance, and it has never really gone away. And that reality is not something that I think we should be particularly proud of, if you get my drift. So go ahead and tell us your take on this.
Well, and as you just described, I mean, post-World War II, the military walked on water.
Yep.
I mean, they could do no wrong. And Roswell was a thriving community of about 50,000 people back in 1947, and they essentially shared a community with the Roswell Army Airfield, which happened to be the headquarters of the first atomic bomb squadron in the world. The very two B-29 bombers, the Enola Gay, that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, and then Boxcar, which dropped the bomb over Nagasaki, were both hangared at Roswell after the war.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, it was just alive with not only military history, but history of the Old West, Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett and John Chisholm and so on. Civil War, the Range Wars, as far as New Mexican Range Wars in the 1960s and beyond, that type of thing. Well, anyway, there was a wonderful bond between the base personnel, even the officers, and the locals, because the locals saw them as their heroes, their defenders, their keepers at the gate. And based in just hobnobbing and associating and, you know, going to the restaurants in town, and what's kind of surprised us very early on was how many of the officers even lived off the base, like Major Jesse Marcel.
Uh-huh.
Who was the head of intelligence? He lived off
the military. The military to Roswell, I guess another way to look at it would be Roswell was kind of like a college town, but it was a military town.
Exactly.
The military was like a college, big university.
Exactly. There was a level of energy that was unsurpassed. Really, you'd have to go to Washington or a big city, New York, Chicago, L.A., that type of thing, to feel that buzz. And Roswell had that. and, you know, the parades and, you know, just witnessing the military, you know, just patrolling through the streets of the small town in their uniforms. And there was just that feeling of just the highest level of patriotism in the country at that time.
Pride, you bet. Yeah.
And then this event happens, which just destroyed that bond, that entire relationship. And it's where everyone became suspect. Everyone was looking over their shoulder, wondering who was spying, who was watching. And to hear the witnesses describe, you know, whether they were stationed at the base or they lived, you know, or they worked at the newspaper. They worked at the funeral home, Ballard Funeral Home in town, that type of thing.
Uh-huh.
That there was a total level of distrust that just blew up almost like a bomb overnight.
And I get it. It turned one against the other.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone was afraid. They didn't trust the military anymore. This is somebody could write a book on just, you guys could maybe, just on the psychology of what happened to humanity and the American citizen as opposed to the military in microcosm
fact,
in Roswell.
It's wonderful that you mentioned that, Jeff, because I wrote up a paper, a magazine article, entitled The Extraordinary Reaction to an Extraordinary Event. And I demonstrated this and the fact that it didn't matter if it was a child who happened to be a son or daughter of mm-hmm. one of the hired hands out at the ranches north of town who were ground zero to the crash, or the highest-ranking military officers at the base. They all reacted, they all behaved, they all used the same verbiage as they described mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. It equalized the playing field. To me, that demonstrated that they were not reading script. They were reacting as human beings to something extraordinary, something beyond the human perception. And I had a noted psychiatrist. He asked me never to use his name for fear that he would, damage his reputation. But he
right.
came up to me after one of my lectures, and he said, you know, Don, I was a staunch skeptic. And I had even read a number of your books, but this was the first time I saw it from my perspective in your paper.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this epiphany, he described. He said, you totally convinced me. And so
nice.
I realized that as often as we've come at this, looking at this sociologically, and as far as the very psychic,
sure.
of the people involved, the psyche of the people involved, and to see that this was way beyond the response or the reaction to a balloon recovery. They were no strangers to the war. Many of them, especially all the personnel, stationed at Roswell, they were
uh-huh.
all survivors of the war. They had seen the worst horrors, imaginable. And then, even the ranchers, they would see down livestock, and they dealt with tragedy on a regular basis. And for all of the testing at the base, there were plane crashes. They
yes,
had to constantly,
I'm sure.
you
yeah.
know, deal with the idea that this was a military region that conducted regular testing and bomb drop exercises. And every day we had witnesses, we had townspeople tell us that whenever they heard the planes fly over,
mm-hmm.
the second thought that always came to mind was, God keep them safe, God keep them up there. Because they knew that the chances were that another one would come down at some point.
Sure.
And they did. And the press would always cover that. The military tried to be very transparent about the situation. But this was different. this was way beyond anything that any of these people had experienced or dealt with before. And that's the one common element in all of this. And so that's where the skeptics are so wrong in suggesting that things even returned to normal after the balloon press conference over at Fort Worth. No, they didn't. Because as you were mentioning and agreeing with me, there was a level of total distrust and to the point of even cynicism and bitterness as to why is the government now treating us like criminals? Why are they treating us as though we are all suspects in the very notion that somebody may say something out of turn, speak, you know, in mixed company about something that they shouldn't have seen? And it created an atmosphere that became caustic to the point that the friendships ended. Even Dr. Edgar Mitchell, who was down in the Pecos Valley area, he went to high school in Roswell, and he talked about how there was absolutely no association with the base personnel, the soldiers, the grunts, the enlisted men, you know, the buck privates who were just happy to have a friend and, you know, even possibly a girlfriend, you know, a local, you know, in the town. And it was pulled out from beneath them, and it was not over a damn weather balloon or a plane crash or a rocket crash or anything else. It was something extraordinary.
I'll bet, if I might just interject here, that not only was the relationship shattered, I'll bet that town, for the rest of that generation's lifetime, was never far from conversation, rumors, anecdotes about that story. That was beyond enormous. It shook that town to its foundations and the people, and they were never the same again.
Never the same.
And this whole thing about trying to pass this off as some kind of a weather balloon thing, it must have really infuriated people. They knew. They had people in the service, on the base. They had people who had, people had been out there cleaning up, picking up wreckage. They knew people in town. They weren't all locked up every night on the base. Go ahead.
And the extreme measures that then, specifically the Pentagon, Washington, went to cover this up, to essentially create this wall around not only Roswell, but the entire state of New Mexico to make sure that nothing leaked out, nothing got out any further than the original press release. And even that was very strategically timed to avoid the newspapers, and yet one newspaper, the San Francisco Chronicle, still managed to get, you know, an actual copy of the press release, you know, on the front page. But it was all very strategic. It was intended to essentially shut Roswell down. There were threats, for example, that came, and we know exactly who the head of the FCC was at that time. It was T.J. Slowey. And we tracked down his background, and sure enough, there he was. And he was the one who called up the radio stations, and specifically WKGF, KGF in Roswell, and threatened them with loss of their license.
Exactly.
If they said anything more about the true nature of the incident.
And as bad, ladies and gentlemen, as that was, and I think many of you get the picture here, the real rude horror of what happened to that community and the military that was beforehand, that military was the hero of the town. When you start threatening local residents with death, and that happened, if they started to talk... And you might want to tell the story of the young lady who that happened to. I can't remember her name now.
Frankie Rowe.
That's Frankie Rowe. That's right. Tell that story just to give you an idea. Now, keep in mind, we had been through the war. The people in Roswell had been through the war. The military was held at the highest regard of this community, its citizenry. There were marriages between military people, local people, et cetera, children. It was like one big family. And all of a sudden, overnight, that family was cut in two, gone. Two pieces,
like a divorce.
No more of a whole. Like a divorce, same thing. Tell us about Frankie Rowe, just briefly.
Well, Frankie Rowe, she was 14 years old at the time, and she had just had her tonsils removed. Her father was a crew chief at the Roswell Fire Department, which was in downtown Roswell, and the firehouse adjoined the courthouse, the sheriff's department at that time. So there was one phone line that came into both buildings. So whoever went to what building, everyone knew about it. The sheriff knew about it, the fire department knew about it, no matter what the story was. And when the ranch foreman, W.W. Brazzo, first reported the crash, the fire department knew about it. And as they were hearing more and more gossip and rumor about it, Frankie's father, Dan Dwyer, he and another firefighter by the name of Ed Reeves, they got into one of their cars, and they drove north of town. They tried to locate, you know, the very ranch and then, you know, get to the very crash site before the military would get there.
Right. May I ask you a question, Don? Hold on. The idea of something crashed there, what was the initial take, the general sense of what did the people think had crashed out there? What was their reflex? What crossed their minds? Something crashed. Was it a B-24? Was it a B-36? What were they thinking? It was something different. Do we know what their thoughts were about what might have had impact with the ground out there on the Brazzo Ranch?
Because of that entire week, actually almost 10 days, leading up to the incident and the arrival of the flying discs and the very coining of the term flying saucer, and then the reward that was being offered between two newspapers and a private individual, a $3,000 total reward for physical evidence. As far as what we have been able to determine, again, whether military, the personnel at the base, or the townspeople, and specifically the ranchers north of town who were involved, all the talk, all the rumor at that time was about a flying saucer crash and little bodies, little men, little people.
Fascinating.
Who were at the crash site. So there was already talk about the victims of the wreck, so to speak. There was already talk about the casualties as a result of the crash. And there was no talk that we have ever discovered about it being a plane crash or even a foreign, you know, spy plane. You know, the idea that on one occasion there was a Russian bear fighter that circled around Roswell from the Mexican border. And that made big news at the time. But nonetheless, it was the only time that such an event took place that was ever recorded. Well, anyway, again, all the talk, flying saucer. And so while Dwyer and Reeves are going to, you know, check this out firsthand, there's a colonel by the name of Woodbury who shows up at the firehouse because he knows about all the talk, all the scuttle. And he talks to the fire chief, and he gathers all the men around in the firehouse, and he threatens them. He tells them that they are not even to discuss it between themselves. They're not to say a word to even their families when they get home that afternoon. The military was in charge of it, and as one of the firemen told us, that Woodbury made the comment, and if we learn of any one of you speaking out of turn, there will be hell to pay. Again, what jurisdiction does the military have over the fire department?
Those poor people in that town, here are our big brothers, our heroes, our military neighbors, friends, and they all turned against one another. They were forced.
Yes.
Like a divorce, an overnight divorce.
Yeah,
boom.
An overnight divorce because, again, the event was that extraordinary. It was something beyond the pale. It was something that was not in their Army
right.
field manual, and it was the only way they could contain it. And the biggest obstacle that they had to deal with was the fact that there were civilians involved, not only civilians who first discovered the debris field and then the final impact site with the bodies, but they had also gone to the sheriff's department and then vis-a-vis the fire department. Mm-hmm. And they had spoken to Frank Joyce at the radio station, KGFL. And so all these civilians who they have absolutely no authority over know the truth. And you can't order them, but you can threaten them, as you just mentioned, Jeff. That's all you can do. You have to silence them. You have to make sure that you put the fear of God into them and that you will not only hurt them,
yeah.
but you will also hurt their families. You will hurt their children. And in poor Frankie Rowe, she stops by the firehouse to visit with her dad. She's just been checked up by the doctor, and she's doing fine.
Okay,
but
hold on, Don, right there, if you would, please. I got to do my break. Perfect place to pause. We'll come back and have Don finish the story about Frankie Rowe. Just had her tonsils out, just given the green light by the doctors. And this is, think about this, though, the reaction. The damage, the psychological damage that it did to the residents of that town when the military turned against them, began to threaten them, literally threaten them under penalty of death, basically. We'll be right back with Don Schmidt. This is a fascinating look at the Roswell event, which I've never heard before. Back in a minute. All right. With Donald Schmidt, and again, the 12 books that Don and Tom have authored about Roswell are just phenomenal reads, every one of them. Now, we're talking about the overnight divorce between, well, a husband and wife, as it were, a family, as it were, Roswell and the U.S. military, the Army Air Force at the Roswell base, and overnight, a fear, a wave, a black wave of trepidation, of worry, of concern, of supreme distrust all of a sudden of the military that had been a part and parcel of that town's heart and soul. This is a huge, huge event. Go ahead, Don, please. This is Frankie Rowe.
Well, and now that you even mentioned it, it's the irony of the fact that that was one of the things in the Nuremberg trials that, you know, that the testimony of the Germans that we heard over and over again, the German officers, we were following orders. Well, we've heard that from a lot of the Roswell officers, that by the manner by which they mistreated and manhandled civilians who were involved, we were just following orders. We were following orders. Yeah, at what point do you say, no, I'm not going to, I don't cross that line. I'm not going to threaten an American, a fellow, citizen. And the point being, they were doing it back in 1947. Because Frankie just happened to stop by the firehouse. She wasn't aware that her dad had, headed north to go check out something she had no idea about. And there had been a state police officer by the name of Robert Scroggins who just happened to, it was his district, the very region, the very area, the county that the crash took place, the debris field was located. And on his way back home, which was in Hobbs to the east of Roswell, he thought he would stop by and show his buddies, show, the firemen, something that the rancher gave him. That he could drop off in town, and he wanted somebody else to be able to display this evidence. It was a piece of the memory material. And Frankie was there as the men were passing it between themselves, and she got the hand of it, and she described how no matter how she crumbled it or crushed it or how she folded it, that it was like quicksilver. That was the word she used. Like it flowed like water, that it, she'd place it back down onto the concrete floor of the firehouse, and it just flowed. It smoothed right out to its original shape and size. Well, little did she know that that night, there'd be a knock at the kitchen door. And her mother, seeing through the window, she saw that it was a military officer and a number of military police. So she quickly sent Frankie and her younger sister, Dottie, into the bedroom. She didn't want them to be around, especially if there was trouble, because her mother had heard, you know, what had all just gone down, what was all happening, you know, just north of the city of Roswell. And Frankie would describe how she heard an argument, she heard a commotion in the kitchen, and didn't know if she should rush to the defense of her mother or even crawl under the bed or out the window, you know. She was starting to panic, and all at once, the bedroom door swings open, and there is an officer, and we know exactly who the officer was. His name was Lieutenant, First Lieutenant Arthur Philbin. Okay. He was a liaison between the base, as far as military personnel, as far as security. And
was he alone?
The town.
Was he solo?
There were three MPs with him.
I figured. Okay.
And she described how he stood there. And we confirmed this with his family. He was 6'4", 250 pounds.
Wow.
Big booming voice. It was like John Wayne standing there and with a baton. And he kept slamming it into his hand. And he kept saying, "Young lady, if you ever utter another word of what you saw and what you held in your hands today, we will take you out in the desert and no one will ever see you again." And that was after her mother was told, "We will kill your children. We will kill your two daughters if you ever talk about this again." This is two Americans. This is between, you know, from a hero to the point that they're now behaving
like the enemy.
And I won't use the word, but they're behaving like our enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And what would again cause them to do that except
a weather balloon?
Yeah, a weather balloon. Uh-huh. And it's like, you skeptics, stop it. Every time you utter a word, you demonstrate not only your ignorance, but that you're nothing but government hacks that are repeating the same deception and the same lies that we've been listening to approaching now 80 years. Now, let's talk about the rancher, for example, who I mentioned earlier, W.W. Brazel.
Yeah, before we leave, Frankie Rowe, 14-year-old girl, 14-year-old girl,
mm-hmm.
scare the holy hell out of her. How can, it's like something, some other unearthly force took over these wonderful servicemen, soldiers, Army Air Corps personnel, and turned them into monsters. This had to have shocked that town beyond my ability to actually measure it, even in retrospect. This is an extraordinary story. Please, go ahead. This is really something. Good job.
So, W.W. Brazel, who reported the debris field, who was going to clean that all up, and he talked about the bodies and the horrible stench to reporter Frank Joyce at KGFL, so the story was all getting out. Okay, to all of your listeners, when does the military have authority over civilians?
It's called posse comitatus.
Yeah.
They're supposed to stay out.
They're supposed to stay out, but only if martial law be declared.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly they couldn't declare martial law over a weather balloon. But nonetheless, they would kidnap, they would take into custody W.W. Brazel. They kept him on the base for 5 full days. They deprived him of water. food, sleep. He would complain later.
All his constitutional rights. It's just thugs. Yeah.
Absolutely no due process. He was not allowed. He was the foreman on the ranch. He was not allowed to call his boss, J.B. Foster, in Western Texas, to even let him know that nobody was tending the 700 cattle and 700 sheep on that 75,000-acre ranch. They didn't even allow him to call his own wife to let her know that he was safe, that he was where he was. They would subject him to an army physical and then a full-body cavity search. He kept talking about the indignity. He kept talking about how he just felt like a piece of raw meat, as he used that term.
This is Soviet Union.
Again, over a weather balloon.
This is crazy.
It's like, you people, again, please stop it. Stop it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, again, you're demonstrating you know nothing about this case. So, here again, a civilian subjected, an American citizen, treated in this manner by the United States military. And then the sheriff, Sheriff George Wilcox. He had taken one of the boxes of wreckage that Brazel had brought into town initially when he came into town on Sunday, July 6th. One of the boxes went out to the base when Major Marcel first received the phone call from the sheriff. He retrieved the box, took it out to the base, and there was the base commander, Colonel Blanchard, who dispatched Marcel, and the head of counterintelligence, Captain Sheridan Cabot, to go investigate. Well, the sheriff had hidden the other box in his closet, right in his office. And his two daughters, Phyllis McGuire and Elizabeth Talk, both described to us how, because their living quarters were upstairs, there was a hallway and a stairway overlooking the front lobby of the courthouse, and their father's office, the sheriff's office, was roadside, was right next to the front steps. They hear a loud commotion of vehicles, the roaring of vehicles coming from all directions around the courthouse. But mind you, this is just within a couple of days after the weather balloon explanation has stuck. People have all breathed a sigh of relief. We're not being invaded. We're not dealing with little men from Mars or anywhere else. It's just the misidentification of a very common weather balloon device. End of story. So they hear these vehicles surrounding the courthouse. And the next thing they hear, men coming in through the kitchen entrance, through the side entrance, and the front door. Armed guards, armed military MPs. And they go directly to their father as they're watching upstairs in the hallway. And they watch two of the MPs grab their father, twist his arm up behind his back, push his face up against the wall, and with guns drawn, demanding to know where the rest of the stuff was, the wreckage. Well, he immediately turns it over. He tells them where it is. They voice a few threats, and then they add the threats to the family as well. And so it's bad enough. You're the sheriff. You're the lead as far as law enforcement official in the entire county. You could go on to the base and arrest the base commander if you had due cause. And yet you're treated like a common criminal in your own office. And the worst of it, in front of your two daughters.
That's terrorism, what it is.
So
I don't understand how the town could possibly ever be the same. It's just no. These stories got out. People talk.
Oh, sure they did.
They knew.
Sure they knew.
There were death threats being given, physically brutalizing people, and quite literally. I don't think that the Army had a K, Army Air Corps, I don't think the Army had a case. They were acting utterly illegally. I don't think there's any justification for that.
No. None whatsoever, because, again, each and every incident, and for each and every civilian involved, would have been a separate violation of their First Amendment rights.
There you go. Yeah.
The Sheriff Wilcox, he was contacted by the military the next morning, and he was ordered to come out to the base. Well, he was smart enough that he suggested he told one of the deputies to come along with him.
Uh-huh.
And one of the daughters, I believe it was Elizabeth, told us that when he came back to the courthouse, he was all disheveled. He looked like he had been roughed up.
Wow.
So in other words, they reinforced the day before threats, so to speak. So it was years later. Now, this was after Wilcox did not run for re-election, and he wound up in an insane asylum within a few years. That's where he would spend the rest of his life. He was mentally tortured. He was mentally defeated. And as his daughter Phyllis told us, the incident destroyed him. Now, again, ladies and gentlemen, how would the recovery of an off-the-shelf balloon of any sort destroy anyone?
Oh, don't even go there, Don. It's not.
I know. Worth it. I know.
It's the damage, the psychological, emotional damage to this town was so big, and it reverberated for probably decades. It slowly faded away as people passed away. But this was huge. It's shocking to hear this, frankly. The ruthlessness and the brutality of the military turned on these people that adored them is staggering. Go ahead.
Frank Joyce at radio station KGFL, who had first heard the story from Brazel as he was reporting this at the sheriff's office. They spoke over the phone. He would have his office ransacked by the military. They cleared out his entire office of any notes, any reference to the true story whatsoever.
Wow.
And within weeks, he is placed, he's put in a mental hospital in El Paso, Texas, where he would spend the next year. No treatment, no medication. He would sit in the hallway and play cards.
No, nothing. Got it.
Nothing. But it was to essentially silence him, discredit him. It's forever, you know, in his resume. He was hospitalized in a mental hospital.
Were there any reports, Don, that you've heard about, you or Tom, in all of your research, any reports of people flat disappeared, gone, never to be seen again kind of thing? Ending up in a mental hospital, be a broken man is bad enough, and that's the sheriff. Did anybody actually disappear, as far as you know? Did they go too far roughing somebody up? You get the picture. Any thoughts about that?
We would hear of the threats. We would hear of certain people that would go into the service, and I'll give you the best example, and this would be Vernon Brazel, Mac Brazel's own son.
Uh-huh.
He went into the Navy when he turned 18. And then he returned in 1960, back to the home ranch, took on a job, had a car, had a girlfriend. Doesn't show up for work one morning. His girlfriend has no idea. Family has no idea. Doesn't pick up his last paycheck. they find his abandoned car down on the California-Mexico border, some quite a few miles away. Family would never hear another word. And this is the Brazos.
Ever?
Not from him. Until.
I was right. I was wondering about this. Go ahead.
Until about 50 years later. 50 years later, a woman comes down into the Corona area seeking out the Brazo family. She wanted to know if the gentleman that she had married was indeed who he claimed he was, or was he someone else. She was from Helena, Montana. Her late husband was identified as Edward Tunnehill. He had Vernon tattooed on his forearm. He committed suicide 6 years after he had disappeared, up in Helena.
Mm-hmm.
When we checked out his Social Security number, it was Vernon Brazel.
Well, are we now, sure he committed suicide?
Are we sure he committed suicide? The family doesn't believe he did. And mm-hmm. the fact that there was no falling out between mm-hmm. Vernon and the family, the idea that his parents would not hear another word, no one, not his brothers Paul or Bill, his sister Bessie, no contact whatsoever. As far as they were concerned, he disappeared off the face of the earth. And the consensus with the family is that Vernon, among a number of other young children, were with Brazo when he found a couple of the bodies 2.5 miles from the debris field atop that bluff. So Vernon had seen everything. He's then in the Navy. He's in the service. Was he talking? Did he become a loose cannon? And did they take, again, appropriate action? Did they essentially create a police protection type of situation? In this case, it was the military. But that they moved him, he took on another name, another identity. And then if he became a further risk, they would take him out and make it look like suicide.
Mm-hmm.
There's too many of these stories throughout the entire Roswell affair. Miriam Bush, who was the secretary to the hospital administrator, and the way she committed supposed suicide, and that she had wrapped a plastic bag over her head and had scratches and bruises all over her arms.
Defensive,
yeah.
Sounds like.
And who commits suicide by wrapping a plastic bag over your head?
No. Doesn't happen.
And I've talked to too many police department. It's like, you're kidding. I mean, talk about the most torturous, you know, that's, you know, it's totally inconceivable that somebody would do it that way. But that was, that's how she committed suicide. And so the situation then, like with the military, was that they were taking the men aside, and they were threatening them with Leavenworth, and also with death if they ever talked about this. Major Marcel was told, you're not to say another word to your family after the balloon press conference, like it never happened. And so they were covering all of their bases, and I think the crowning example was one of the very arbiters of the cover-up, and that was Brigadier General Roger Ramey, who staged a balloon press conference at his very office at Carswell Army Airfield. And after they had substituted the balloon and the radar reflector kite, the rubber, the foil, the sticks, the string, and the tape for the actual material, Marcel was then brought back into the room, and he's ordered to pose with it. We had interviewed Ramey's chief of staff, Colonel Thomas J. DeBose.
Right.
And DeBose took him aside right after the photographs were taken. You are never to bring this up again. It never happened. Well, where have we heard that before?
Yeah.
In other words, erase it from your mind. It never took place.
So we're just about out of time, Don, but to sum it up, it would be fair to say that the military crushed that town and actually ultimately killed some of its residents to shut them up. I think that's
I truly have no doubt. I truly have no doubt. Quickly, we're looking into a reported drive-by shooting of a five-year-old child at one of the officers who was just playing in the front yard, and the officer supposedly was talking. And there were a number of other strange suicides and things that we're also looking into. But there's a trail. There's a body trail.
Yes, and not ET bodies either. I want it both. I want to thank you for this because it's been a very unusual journey this hour. Very helpful to understand the dynamic of this whole crash and cover-up. And if you think the government's much different now, you better think again. I've said it for years and years. They kill people if they get in the way. They have no qualms, whatever. And it started back in earnest long ago. All right. Wow.
Heavy hour.
Very. I'll remember this for forever. And if we need to follow up on it in any way, shape, or form, let me know. Look forward to talking to you next month, Don. Be safe out there. Be careful. And thank you for sharing this again.
Thank you, Jeff. It's always a pleasure. You stay safe and healthy as well. And I look forward to the next time. Thank you, Jeff.
Okay, my friend. Oh, should we say anything else? Should we say anything else, Don?
Talk about the next show, right? Quickly.
Yeah, real quick.
Yeah. Many of us got involved in this subject due to a very popular and an iconic TV show from the late 60s called The Invaders. And the very star of the show, who played the lead character, David Vincent, is actor Roy Thinnes. And Roy will be joining the two of us, the very next show that we get together. So a month from tonight.
Thank you, Don. Talk to you soon.
Look forward to it.
Okay,
thanks, Jeff.
Good
you
night.
Too. Take care.
All right. It was a remarkable hour. And yes, Roy Thinnes will be with us next month. Roy also was in several episodes of The X-Files, as you remember. Powerful performance, terrific performance. So that'll be next month for you. Okay, hang on. Be right back.